Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we have been often veering off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. Thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. So today's podcast will be on true crime science paraphilias. Now, it goes without saying that this will be touching rather scandalous topics regarding sexual themes that are generally considered not typical or common in nature. And if you know me, I will get into details, so if this isn't for you, that is perfectly fine. Trust me, no hard feelings. We all have strong opinions when it comes to these types of things. So, I get it. But let's dive in. The National Library of Medicine, National Center for Biotechnology Information, defines paraphilias as, quote, persistent and recurrent sexual interests, urges, fantasies, or behaviors of marked intensity involving objects, activities, or even situations that are atypical in nature, end quote. And really, all of the sources that I checked all pretty much said that exact same thing, nearly verbatim. So Psychology Today, which is one of my favorite sources, defines paraphilias as, quote, a condition in which a person's sexual arousal and gratification depend on fantasizing about and engaging in sexual behavior that is atypical and extreme. A paraphilia is considered a disorder when it causes distress or threatens to harm someone else. A paraphilia can revolve around a particular object, like children, animals, underpants, or a particular behavior, like inflicting pain or exposing yourself. It is distinguished by a preoccupation with the object or behavior to the point of being dependent on that object or behavior for sexual gratification. Most paraphilias are more common in men than in women. The focus of a paraphilia is usually very specific and unchanging. Since many well-functioning people have sexual interests that fall outside of traditional sexual conduct or the vanilla baby, a diagnosis of a paraphilic disorder is only given if there is accompanying personal distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning, or if the behavior causes harm to a non-consenting party. And lastly, according to the American Psychiatric Association, quote, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, my beloved DSM, the Holy Bible to me, paraphilic disorders are often misunderstood as a catch-all definition for any unusual sexual behavior. The Sexual and Gender Identity Disorders Work Group sought to draw a line between atypical human behavior and behavior that causes mental distress to a person or makes the person a serious threat to the psychological and physical well-being of other individuals. While legal implications of paraphilic disorders were considered seriously in revising diagnostic criteria, the goal was to update the disorders in this category based on the latest science and effective clinical practice. That is a whole lot of very fancy, you know, top shelf stuff. And really, there is tons and tons and tons of information about this. These are just three of some of my favorite sources, but again, they all pretty well agree. Now, there are, as of this recording, 8 established and agreed upon paraphilias. We have exhibitionism, frauderism, voyeurism, fetishism, pedophilia, sexual masochism, sexual sadism, transvestic fetishism, and then there really is a 9th, but it's just, you know, quote, paraphilia not otherwise specified, meaning we know something is wrong, but it doesn't fall under the 8 labels. The not otherwise specified acts as a sort of placeholder. We love the NOS, right? So what exactly are these? Some of them we know, we're pretty familiar with, but perhaps some others we aren't. And also, I've covered sexual sadism in a previous True Crime Science episode, so I've linked that in the notes if you want to watch it, but let's get into what each of these are. So we have exhibitionism. This one, most of us are pretty knowledgeable about. They generally expose their genitals, and yes, it's usually always a male, to unsuspecting strangers, and this is quite sexually arousing for them. They are also mostly aware of their need to kind of surprise, you know, catch off guard, shock, or they think impress the unwilling observer, although most of the time we're not impressed. The victim is almost always a woman or a child of either sex. But actual sexual contact is nearly never the outcome they are going for, so exhibitionists rarely commit rape. It's not out of the question, but it is rare. The prevalence in the population of this is somewhere kind of thought between 2-4% in men and much, much lower in women. Some interesting information. Exhibitionism most often begins in adolescence, perhaps just after puberty, but it isn't out of the question for it to begin before adolescence or even as late as middle age, but again, rare. And believe it or not, exhibitionists are usually married, though the marriage tends to be kind of a bit rocky. For some, exhibitionism displays as a strong desire to have other people watch or witness their sexual acts. These people want to be seen by a consenting audience rather than to catch people off guard. People with this form of exhibitionism may make, private sex videos, pornographic videos, or become entertainers in the adult or porn industry. But the difference is that this particular flavor is rarely distressed or their daily life otherwise impaired by this desire. So they may not have a mental health disorder. Most people with exhibitionistic tendencies do not have an actual disorder. But the ones with the sort of kind of clinical exhibitionism may also have a coexisting personality disorder, such as antisocial personality disorder or conduct disorder, if, of course, they're under the age of 18. The criteria to be officially diagnosed with exhibitionism as a paraphilic disorder are, quote, people have been repeatedly and intensely aroused by exposing their genitals or being observed by other people during sexual activity, and the arousal has been expressed in fantasies, intense urges, or behaviors. As a result, people feel greatly distressed or become less able to function well at work, in their family, or in interactions with friends, or they have acted on their urges with a person who does not or did not consent, and they have had the condition for 6 months or more. The having this condition 6 months or more is pretty much across the board. I'll just give you that hint. But in diagnosing exhibitionistic disorder, the doctor will also specify whether the person is sexually aroused by exposing their genitals to prepubescent children or physically mature individuals, or both. Is it treatable? Well, usually they aren't treated until they're caught or arrested. Then they are evaluated and given therapy, or perhaps they can join support groups and certain antidepressants like SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Celexa, Lexapro, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, you know, the usuals. And remember this antidepressant list because this is kind of nearly across the board as well, kind of across the board. But if those are not effective, they may be prescribed medications that alter the sex drive more intensely while also reducing testosterone levels. These medications include leuprolide and medroxyprogesterone acetate. Interesting fact. About 30% of male sex offenders who are arrested are exhibitionists. They tend to persist in their behavior. About 20 to 50% are re-arrested. So the next paraphilia is frauderism. This is the intense sexual arousal from touching or rubbing against a non-consenting person. This disorder is diagnosed when a person has acted on these sexual urges or the urges cause significant distress or impaired functioning. Now, these folks appear to get excited at the very risk of getting caught in a public place doing what it is they do, the voodoo that they do. Most cases of frauderism involve males touching females, but there are some rare cases of females touching males. Then again, the latter might be underreported as men are less likely to report sexual assault. Hashtag men too. There have also been cases of adults of either sex touching children. When an adult displays these behaviors, it is still considered a crime because it is a form of non-consensual sex. It is considered a crime. Do not do it. And apparently we don't even know how common this one is. Sources all stated it has not been studied as it really should be. No one knows exactly how frauderism gets started, but the causes are thought to be a sort of combination of psychological, social, and biological factors, which is about as generic a statement as you can get in this field. Well, we don't really know, but we think it's a combo of, you know, psychosocial, regular social, biology, you know, nature versus nurture. Although it can start at any age, the problem is most often seen in young, seemingly shy males between the ages of 15 and 25. However, there are some theories as to the root cause, which again focus on social issues that result in a kind of lacking of consenting partners. You know, they're just not able to find a consenting partner. And others on an inability to control one's sex drive. But ultimately, what causes the disorder remains unknown. Conditions that might coexist with frauderism may include hypersexuality or other paraphilic disorders. Most commonly, voyeurism, which we are about to get to, and exhibitionism, as well as non-sexual antisocial personality disorder, conduct disorder, depression, anxiety, substance abuse disorders, or a possible brain injury. We can never discount a brain injury. A history of experiencing their own sexual abuse may play a role in the development of this disorder, especially when signs of the disorder appear at an early age. Individuals with frauderistic disorder generally do not go out and seek treatment on their own and really only receive help after they have already been arrested for sexual assault and treatment is therefore mandated by the courts. And since those with frauderistic tendencies tend to act quickly in crowded, you know, public spaces and often are able to successfully disappear or blend into a crowd without getting caught, there is very little reliable information on either prevalence or treatment success rates. And side note, just so you know, anyone that comes up on me grinding and mashing themselves on me is getting an elbow to the teeth. That is a guarantee. But if they are caught or they come forward for help, the standard treatments include, you know, medication and psychotherapy, the huge. And when it comes to the medications, hormones and certain antidepressants may be used to help diminish the sexual desire, much like the exhibitionists. Remember, I told you to remember those medications. Behavioral or cognitive behavioral therapy and relaxation training can help manage sexual urges and redirect thoughts to, you know, more appropriate ways of dealing with inappropriate sexual impulses and behaviors. So let's move on to voyeurism. Voyeurism involves becoming sexually aroused by watching an unknowing person who is taking off or changing their clothes, or they're already naked, or engaging in sexual activities. Now, voyeuristic disorders involve acting on voyeuristic urges or fantasies, or being distressed by or unable to function because of those urges and fantasies. A voyeur may also film these acts for later viewing. Voyeurs are also known as, you know, peeping toms, and we hear about those regularly with our serial killers, who use binoculars, mirrors, peeping into windows, recording cameras while peering through peepholes and windows. But it is important to know that most voyeurs do not actually have full-blown voyeuristic disorder. Having flavors of or having tendencies toward do not mean there is a full-blown disorder. Voyeuristic disorder is one of the most common paraphilias and is much more common among men. The ratio of male to female voyeurs was said to be between 2-to-1 and 3-to-1. What little is known about voyeuristic disorder is largely derived from people who have been imprisoned for this behavior. Many offenders may also be hypersexual and have any or a number of other mental health conditions, including, surprise, surprise, exhibitionist disorder, depression, conduct disorder, or antisocial personality disorder. And you're going to hear these terms over and over. So when voyeurism is an actual disorder, they spend a lot of time seeking out these viewing opportunities. They are heavily preoccupied with it, and as a result, they may neglect important aspects of their life and not tend to their very real responsibilities. Voyeurism may become the preferred method of sexual activity and consume countless hours of watching. And just like the first two, there is no specific cause that has been determined for voyeuristic disorder. But certain risk factors tend to coincide with a person becoming a voyeur, including substance abuse, sexual abuse, and being hypersexualized. Some experts suggest that, given the opportunity, many people actually have voyeuristic tendencies, but, you know, they're afraid to admit it or they're afraid to get caught. Voyeuristic disorder may stem from an accidental sighting of someone who is naked, disrobing, or participating in sexual activity. Continued viewing then sort of reinforces and perpetuates this behavior to a point where it goes beyond what is considered culturally or socially acceptable or, you know, quote, normal, and it thus becomes pathological. Treatment usually begins when voyeurs are arrested, just like the others. It includes psychotherapy, support groups, medicines to lower testosterone, and antidepressants, all the same stuff, broken record. So, moving on to fetishism. This word is hard to say a whole bunch of times in succession, so here we go. Fetishistic disorder is an intense sexual attraction to either inanimate objects or to body parts not really traditionally viewed as sexual, coupled with clinically significant distress or impairment. Now, according to the DSM-5, the beloved DSM-5, fetishistic disorder is a condition in which there is a persistent and repetitive use of or dependence on non-living objects such as undergarments or high-heeled shoes, or a highly specific focus on a body part, most often non-genital, such as feet. Looking at you, Quentin Tarantino. They need these to reach sexual arousal. Feet pick people, we see you. But let it be known, I am not kink-shaming. Moving on. If sexual arousal occurs mainly from wearing clothing of the opposite sex, that is, cross-dressing, rather than using the clothing in some other way, the paraphilia is considered transvestism, which we will get into in a bit. But people with fetishistic disorder may not be able to perform, if you will, without their fetish item. may not be able to perform. The fetish may replace typical sexual activity with a partner, or may be sort of integrated into sexual activity with a willing partner. The fact is that the need for the fetish may be so intense and compulsive that it becomes sort of all-consuming and destructive in that person's life. But in most people who have a particular fetish, their behavior does not meet the criteria for a disorder because it does not cause them significant distress, interfere with their daily functioning, or, you know, they're not harming anyone. Now, since fetishes do happen in many normally developing people, an official diagnosis of fetishistic disorder is only given if there is also personal distress or impairment in social activities, or at work, or other important areas of functioning as a result of the fetish, or when sexual arousal is impossible without the fetish object. Okay? So people who identify as fetishists but do not feel the actual intense, you know, sort of clinical impairment, if you will, would be considered to have a fetish, but not fetishistic disorder. Now, most people find other parts of the body attractive, hands, eyes, that booty, you know, which means that some level of fetishism is a normal feature of human sexuality. But the attraction isn't consuming your thoughts, you know, to the point that you are having a hard time socially at work, you know, you get it, you get it. And then to get into it further, it turns out that the inanimate object fetishes can be categorized into two types. This I didn't know. Form fetishes and media fetishes. So according to Psychology Today, in a form fetish, the shape of the object is important, such as a high-heeled shoe. In a media fetish, the material of the object, such as silk or leather, is important. Inanimate object fetishes often collect the object of their favor, by the way. And predictably, fetishistic disorder is much more common in males than females. In fact, the DSM-5 says that it appears almost exclusively in males. So what causes it, right? Well, fetishistic disorder typically hits at the onset of puberty, but they can develop prior to adolescence. One of our very own subjects, Jerry Brudos, had this, and of course I've covered him, if you're interested in listening. But no cause for fetishistic disorder has been sort of conclusively established. But you know we have theories, right? So these theories include childhood experiences, biological factors such as abnormal brain development, and cultural factors, as studies have shown different rates of fetishism in cultures that approach sexuality differently from each other. So then it kind of begs the question, are there neurological causes of fetishism? Well, one neurological idea around the cause of foot fetishes comes from the fact that the region in the brain that processes sensory information from the feet is right next to the area that processes sensory information from the genitals. This idea suggests that there may be some kind of, quote, neural crosswalk between the two brain areas. So this is kind of some big stuff, but stick with me here. Body parts whose cortical representation in the brain that is further away from that of the genitals are less likely to be fetishized, as feet are the most common fetish. And wouldn't you know it, having an actual fetish disorder is one of the very hard ones to treat with real effectiveness. Fetishistic fantasies are common and in many cases harmless. According to the DSM definition, they should only be treated as a disorder when they cause distress or impair a person's ability to function normally in their day-to-day life. Same old, same old. And while a number of therapy-based and medication-based treatments can help sort of control symptoms of this disorder, patients should know that they have historically been, or there have been historical limitations on the degree to which therapy and medication or a combination of the two can really help. It's kind of limited. These therapies typically treat more the symptoms, the anxiety, the shame, relationship problems that bring a patient in to be treated in the first place. But many people with fetishes very well might still desire their fetish item long term. But, you know, the hope is that the outcome of the various therapies will at least help them better cope. Okay, now to talk about transvestic fetishism or transvestic disorder. I know this is going to be a touchy one. According to Psychology Today, transvestic disorder occurs when an individual experiences recurrent, intense sexual arousal from cross-dressing or dressing as the opposite gender, and in which that person's urge to do so causes significant distress or impairment to their daily life. Cross-dressing may include wearing only a single article of clothing typically associated with the opposite gender, underwear or a bra. Or it could be a complete outfit along with hair and full glam. Transvestic disorder is a rare diagnosis and is classified as a paraphilia or atypical sexual behavior. A person with transvestic disorder may feel depression, guilt, or shame because of their urge to cross-dress. The negative feelings that they are, you know, experiencing are usually a result of disapproval from their partner or their own concern about negative social or professional ramifications. But it's important to note that most people who cross-dress do not fit into the diagnostic criteria for transvestic disorder. That's important. Cross-dressing is done for many reasons, including a desire to challenge gender norms. I mean, for me, I buy t-shirts from the men's section. That doesn't mean I have transvestic disorder. It just means that men's t-shirts are more roomy and comfy for me. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying. It can be seen as an act of sexual liberation or an exploration of one's gender identity. Most people who experience transvestic disorder are heterosexual men. That is important. One of the most common reasons people look to treatment for the disorder is because it interferes with their romantic relationships or marriages with women. But again, most cross-dressers do not have a psychiatric disorder. They may have transvestism rather than transvestic disorder. Doctors diagnose transvestic disorder only when people are, quote, greatly distressed by or cannot function well because of their desire to cross-dress or because of interference in other areas of their lives by the time and expense spent engaging in cross-dressing, end quote. No medications are reliably effective, but psychotherapy, when needed, may help people accept themselves and control behaviors that could cause problems in their life. And if I may give my personal ideas about that, again, as I said, I wear men's t-shirts. I wear men's jeans sometimes because I'm just not a real hippie. I don't have a lot of hip going on, you know. Women's jeans don't fit me well. That doesn't mean that I'm even cross-dressing. But if I am okay with wearing men's t-shirts, men's jeans, or walking around the house in men's boxers, why is it not okay for men to go around in clothing that has been sewn to better fit a female's body? You know, I just find there are more important things to bitch about in the world than what people are wearing. You know what I mean? Anyway, moving on. So, like nearly all of the others, there really isn't any specific cause that's been found for transvestic disorder. It has been found that in childhood, cross-dressing sometimes causes a level of excitement, which may, after puberty, become sexual excitement. Heterosexual males who dress in women's clothing typically begin such behavior in late childhood. This behavior is associated, I mean, at least initially, with intense sexual arousal. As the person ages through adulthood and the behavior is repeated and reinforced, the desire to cross-dress may become stronger, even if sexual gratification diminishes. Too much indulgence in anything can be bad, as they say. Doctors will assign a diagnosis of transvestic disorder when the people have been, you know, repeatedly and intensely aroused by cross-dressing, and the arousal has been expressed in fantasies, intense urges, or behaviors. And then, as a result, people feel greatly distressed or become less able to function well at work, within their family units, or in interactions with friends. And then if they have had the condition for 6 months or more, again, that 6 months or more thing is pinned on the table, glued to the table. Most cross-dressers do not have transvestic disorder. As I said, in making the diagnosis of transvestic disorder, the doctor specifies whether a person has a fetish or autogynephilia, which is a man's arousal by thoughts or images of himself as a woman. Ways to treat are social and support groups for men who cross-dress, which are often actually quite helpful. Psychotherapy, at least when needed, is focused on helping people accept themselves and control behaviors that could cause problems. You know, nobody cares if a man's wearing pink silk panties under their office attire. I know I don't. So don't be ashamed, dude. You do you. If it makes you happy, go for it. Predictably, there are no medications that are reliably effective, even if someone with transvestic disorder asks for such treatment. So that's the end of that one. The next one is sexual masochism. Now, this involves recurrent, intense, sexually arousing fantasies, urges, or behaviors that are distressing or disabling and have the potential to cause harm to oneself or others. Now, the sadism and the masochism are kind of their own beast. But sexual masochism refers to engaging in or frequently fantasizing about being beaten, bound, humiliated, or otherwise made to suffer, resulting in sexual satisfaction. People being degraded, you know, people get off on that. If people with this sexual preference report psychological or social problems as a result, they may be diagnosed with sexual masochism disorder. The types of distress that people with this disorder may experience include severe anxiety, guilt, shame, and obsessive thoughts about engaging in sexual masochism. In contrast, if a person with sexually masochistic desires declares no distress or anxiety or guilt or shame about these paraphilic impulses and are not hampered by them in the course of their daily life, they could be determined to have masochistic sexual interest, but should not be diagnosed with sexual masochism disorder. Now, as we all know, some amount of sadism and masochism is commonly kind of play-acted in very healthy sexual relationships, and mutually compatible partners often seek each other out. For example, the use of soft handkerchiefs or fuzzy handcuffs for simulated bondage and mild spanking during sexual activity are common practices between, and here's the big word, consenting partners, and they are not considered sadomasochistic. Most people who engage in masochistic activities are very open about their involvement in BDSM, which, for those who don't know, means bondage, domination, sadism, masochism activities. Most interact with a consenting partner who may have sexual sadism, which is the next subject. In these relationships, the humiliation and beating are simply acted out, with participants knowing that it is a game and carefully avoiding actual humiliation or actual injury, often by using a pre-negotiated safe word. And for a fun group activity, why don't you all drop what your official safe words are in the comments? I'm wildly curious. However, some masochists increase the severity of their activity with time and may stop using their safe word as a way to protect themselves, which can potentially lead to serious injury or even death. Treatment of masochism is not necessary if the person is not significantly distressed or impaired by their behavior. But in some cases, using a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and anti-androgen medications, which work by blocking the effects of testosterone, can be beneficial. So again, much like the other paraphilias. One specific type of sexual masochism is called asphyxiophilia, in which a person receives sexual satisfaction by having their breathing restricted. And I see a lot of you dropping memes about being choked. Y'all are crazy. So while some people engage in this practice with partners, others prefer to restrict their breathing while they are alone, and accidental death may happen as a result. So be careful out there, my little fiends. Sexually masochistic behavior is usually evident by early adulthood and sometimes begins with masochistic or sadistic play during childhood. There is no universally accepted theory explaining the root of sexual masochism. However, several ideas have been presented. So one theory suggests that paraphilias originate when inappropriate sexual fantasies are forbidden and become stronger as they are suppressed. Another theory suggests that sadomasochistic behavior is a form of escape from one's thoughts and allows the practitioner to enter into something resembling a meditative state. Through acting out fantasies, individuals allow themselves to feel new and different. Another theory suggests that childhood trauma, such as sexual abuse, can later manifest in a paraphilic disorder. And so, then we move on to sexual sadism disorder. Sexual sadism involves acts in which a person experiences sexual excitement from inflicting physical or psychological suffering on another person. And again, I have covered this. The link is in the notes. But I'll give, you know, the short and pretty. Sexual sadism disorder is a sexual sadism that causes significant distress, substantially interferes with daily functioning, harms another person, or involves someone who has not given consent. Most sadists interact with a consenting partner who may have sexual masochism. That is, you know, he or she experiences this sexual excitement from being humiliated, beaten, and bound, or otherwise abused. In these relationships, the humiliation and beating are simply acted out, with participants knowing that it is a game, carefully avoiding actual humiliation or injury, the same as under masochism. Fantasies of total control and dominance are often important, and sadists may bind and gag their partner in elaborate ways. When practiced with non-consenting partners, sexual sadism is considered a crime and is likely to continue until the sadist is apprehended. So the most extreme of this would be someone like the Toy Box Killer, David Parker Ray, or the Toolbox Killers, the two guys in the van in California. Okay. Sexual sadism is not synonymous with rape. It is a complex mixture of coerced sex and power exerted over the victim. Sexual sadism is diagnosed in fewer than 10% of rapists, but in 37 to 75% of people who have committed sexually motivated homicides. Sexual sadism is particularly dangerous in people who also have antisocial personality disorder. Now, there is limited evidence that using a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and anti-androgen medications, again, works by trying to block some of the effects of the testosterone, these can be beneficial. If antisocial personality disorder is also present, treatments have not been shown to be particularly effective. While no specific causes have been determined for sexual sadism disorder, there are theories. You know there are theories. These include escapism, or a feeling of power for someone who normally feels powerless in day-to-day life, release of suppressed sexual fantasies, or progressive acting out of sadistic sexual fantasies over time. Other psychiatric or social disorders may be diagnosed along with sexual sadism disorder, though they are not necessarily the cause. But recent research suggests that sort of engaging in sadistic sexual behaviors is driven by a desire for feelings of power and dominance, in addition to simply sexual pleasure. You know, some people just feel that every aspect and facet of their lives are controlled to what they can and cannot wear to work, what they can and cannot act like in public, whether they can have vibrant hair or tattoos, and, you know, feeling dominant over another person and controlling their movements and controlling their behaviors in a fun and sexual way may not sound like that big of a deal. Like, it's not bad. And this is true for those in the general population with a sexually sadistic fetish and for those with a severe enough condition to be diagnosed with sexual sadism disorder. The relationship between sexual sadism and sadistic pornography is actually unclear. There is evidence that pornography may encourage the conversion of sexual fantasy to sexual offense, while other research suggests that those with sexually sadistic desires seek out sexually sadistic pornography, so it's purposeful. A study of 512 men and women in Mozambique showed that men's frequent exposure to pornography was correlated with sadistic behavior by men towards women. So just, you know, food for thought. And that is sexual sadism. And I really don't want to touch the next one, but we kind of have to, right? Integrity, integrity. So now we have the one that everyone really hates to talk about, right? Pedophilia. According to Psychology Today, pedophilia is an ongoing sexual attraction to prepubescent children. It is a paraphilia, a condition in which a person's sexual arousal and gratification depends on objects, activities, or even situations that are considered atypical. Pedophilia is defined as recurrent and intense sexually arousing fantasies, sexual urges, or behaviors involving sexual activity with a prepubescent child or children, generally aged 13 years or younger. There's another name for people attracted to 14-year-olds to 17-year-olds. It's a completely different category. And over a period of at least 6 months. So again, there's that blanket 6 months statement. Pedophiles are more often men and can be attracted to either or both sexes. Pedophilic disorder can be diagnosed in people who are willing to disclose this paraphilia, as well as in people who deny any sexual attraction to children but demonstrate objective evidence of pedophilia. For the condition to be diagnosed, an individual must either act on their sexual urges or experience significant distress or interpersonal difficulty as a result of their urges or fantasies. Without these two criteria, a person may have pedophilic sexual desires, but not pedophilic disorder. So the prevalence of pedophilic disorder is unknown, as the social stigma around it does not invite people to self-identify. And of course, we know this. Estimates of its prevalence range from 1 to 5% of the male population. There are believed to be only a small fraction of a percent of women, if any at all, who experience pedophilia. Now, that's what the literature says. I firmly believe that there are women that experience pedophilia. It says, you know, small fraction of a percent of women, if any at all. I think it's the small fraction. But I do believe that female pedophilia does exist. I personally actually also believe that these percentages are higher than that. Because again, there are non-offenders who do not report and offenders who aren't caught and don't report. So I think 1 to 5% is a conservative number. I also think that there might very well be a bit of a higher percentage in women as well for the same reasons. And as much as I have a very hard time when it comes to the whole umbrella of pedophilia, I want you guys to know, because I think it's important. I listen to things while I'm working, and things like Soft White Underbelly is a good example, but there are many channels that interview pedophiles, and it is an uncomfortable conversation. I do not enjoy listening to them speak about these things, but I also find it very important that you listen to all sides, whether you agree or disagree, whether it's pedophilia all the way up to freaking politics. If we are going to address it and make it better and protect our children, we are going to have to hear from the people that are willing to step forward and talk about this particular paraphilia. So that's me now stepping off of that soapbox. Now, Pedophilic sexual offenders are usually family, friends, or relatives of their victims. The types of pedophilic activities vary and may include just looking at a child, all the way to undressing and touching a child. However, acts often involve oral sex, I just hate to say that, or touching the genitals of the child or the offender. Studies suggest that children who feel uncared for or lonely may be at a higher risk for sexual abuse, or, and let's get personal here, in my case, it was a mother whose social life of dive bars and partying that was so important that she left me with people who did things to me. Now, according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, our beloved DSM-5, in order for pedophilic disorder to be diagnosed, the following criteria must be met. So here's the bullet points. I took this straight from there, okay? 1. Recurrent intense sexual fantasies, urges, or behaviors with a prepubescent child, generally age 13 or younger, for a period that will last at least what? What's the blanket time? Correct, 6 months. These sexual urges have been acted on or have caused significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. The person is at least 16 years old and at least 5 years older than the child with whom the person engages in sexual behavior. This does not include an individual in late adolescence involved in an ongoing sexual relationship with a 12 or 13-year-old. And on a personal note, that is still completely disgusting. Additionally, a diagnosis of pedophilic disorder should specify whether the individual is exclusively attracted to children or not. So is it exclusively children or is it children plus normal adult attraction? It should specify the gender that the individual is attracted to and also whether the sexual urges are limited to children in the person's own family, which I found interesting. Why would they only be attracted to children of their own bloodline and not other children? So that's a curious one for me. And it should come as no surprise that there are a number of challenges to diagnosing pedophilia. People who have this condition rarely seek help voluntarily. Counseling and treatment often come as a result of a court order. And as touchy as this particular label is, it does bear having an important conversation about, as I've said. So yes, pedophilic disorder has been classified as a psychiatric diagnosis under the DSM-5 since 1968. It is not a choice people consciously make. And I want to make sure that you understand that. Pedophilia can be treated with long-term individual or group psychotherapy and medications that reduce testosterone levels and thus reduce the sex drive. These medications include, you know, the same ones that we've already discussed that lower testosterone or raise progesterone. Results of treatment vary, unfortunately. The outcome is best when participation is, again, voluntary, and the person receives training in social skills and treatment of other problems, such as drug misuse or depression. Self-medicating is not the answer to pedophilia. Treatment that is sought out only after criminal apprehension and legal action may be less effective because they got caught. They didn't willingly come forward saying, I realize that I'm actually attracted to children and I really don't want to be and I need some help. You know, people that are caught are not doing that. Simply putting pedophiles in prison or another institution for a long time will not change pedophilic desires or fantasies. However, some imprisoned pedophiles who are committed to long-term monitored treatment, usually including medications, can refrain from pedophilic activity and be reintegrated into society. Now, I know some of you are scrunching your face, you're cussing me, and I know. I know that last bit stings because we are out here in this world, and let's be brutally honest, we don't want them reintegrated into society for there to even be a tiny possibility that they will offend. Many of them say it's a victimless crime or the child wasn't murdered or very badly harmed, but they are badly harmed. The scars might not show on the skin, but the mental wounds are hard to heal. The memories, the flashbacks, and pain and embarrassment are all very real, even to this day. I mean, for me anyway, and I suspect many of you as well. When we say a child cannot consent, some think that if the child is into it, then it can't be that bad. These minor attracted persons that are trying to fight for rights for this shit. Okay? Ooh, I'm trying not to get mad. Because I think that that is utter and complete bullshit. Children's brains are still so very immature and forming, barely wrinkled, and they simply are not capable of processing such huge amounts of complicated emotions and feelings. The child might not be left, you know, bleeding or battered, but the Vietnam flashbacks for the rest of their lives, horrific. My first real memory of this was 4 years old, and the scene is tattooed into my mind forever. I have kids, and I don't talk about that much, but I do. So there is a very real part of me that wants to end pedophiles. But the educated, science-minded part of me knows that this is something they cannot seem to help. They are born that way, if you want to say that. Their sexual attraction to children is, in many ways, kind of the same as Jerry Brudos' attraction to high-heel shoes. It cannot be helped. Okay, so for those that realize they have a sexual attraction to children and they never act on it, never harm a child, they're horrified by it, right? So they're taking steps to ensure that they will never touch a child. They medicate, they stay physically distant from children, whatever they need to do, I applaud that. I am not calling for the murder of all pedophiles. It's ridiculous. But it's also very hard for me to empathize. But I do make an effort so long as they don't offend. But if they offend, knowing it is wrong, well then, I just don't have anything nice to say. Keep your fucking hands off of children. Period. Full stop. I will move on because this subject is very triggering for me and I'm quite sure plenty of you. So, we have learned that paraphilias as a group have a high rate of comorbidity with one another, and an equally high rate of comorbidity with anxiety, major depression, or mood disorders, and substance abuse disorders. Comorbidity means two different things that are kind of running along side by side, okay? The exact cause of paraphilias and paraphilic disorders is largely unknown. However, it is thought that a combination of neurobiological, interpersonal, and cognitive processes all play a role. Sources also point towards various genetic factors contributing to the development of pedophilia and pedophilic disorder, with recent evidence displaying, I'm going to throw kind of some science-y shit at you, okay, displaying a positive correlation of the COMT VAL158-MET RS4680, polymorphism in paraphilic child sexual offenders. So let me explain that. When it comes to pedophilia and pedophilic disorder, there is something to be said for a genetic component, referring to the presence of two or more variant forms of a specific DNA sequence that can occur among different individuals or populations. So there is that, okay? Biological factors are likely influencing and attuned elements in sexually deviant behavior. The observation that paraphilic behavior tends to cluster in some families is, at least to me, very intriguing and potentially raises questions as to whether shared genetic factors may play a role in the transmission of paraphilias. So the consensus, really, is that most of us don't care what you do privately with your consenting partners that pose no real harm. Most of us don't kink shame. Where we have the problem is when the partner is non-consenting or a victim, or most assuredly children, are just flat out not to be touched at all. Do what you will, but harm no one. That's my motto. You do you, but make sure your partners are consenting. That's it. Okay? It's pretty simple. So I hope you guys enjoyed this one. And you know, I got some very good feedback about the Tuskegee experiment. After that one, I actually had several people ask me to cover eugenics as well as the experiment in Guatemala. So you guys, my beloved listeners, you let me know if you want me to cover the experiment in Guatemala, which was the Tuskegee experiment on steroids, basically, as well as the overall umbrella of eugenics, as far as, you know, kind of how that's played a role in our, when I say recent society, I'm talking like, you know, World War I, II-ish, up to today. So you guys let me know for sure. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you keep choosing me, and I still appreciate that after all of these years, guys. You're amazing. Thank you so, so much. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.